Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let's pray. Gracious God, we thank you for the gift of young life and for the young lives that are a part of this family of faith. And we ask you to be with us as people who love and care for them, to be intentional and think about what it means to have faith and how we can share our faith with them and invite them into the broader life of the church. We ask that you give us hearts to see and minds to see and eyes and ears to see and hear all that you would have us know. In the name of Christ we pray.
Just really quickly from last week, I had a couple of emails and text messages about the Brene Brown stuff and people who are really kind of interested in learning more and digging their teeth more deeply into some of that stuff, which we just kind of barely scraped the surface of. So if that applies to you as well, please feel free to shoot me an email and I can share some more resources and talk about the potential of somewhere down the line doing some more work with Brene Brown's stuff on wholehearted parenting from last week.
Our tradition is that our theology is in those official books that we have. And we have actually many of them, not just the Book of Common Prayer, but also all of the hymnals that are official. We have the Hymnal 1982, but there are several others. And it's through those texts that we find out more about our faith. And so if you haven't already been to church this morning, pay attention to some of the words. There's a couple hymns this morning that have amazing words. And that's part of our faith tradition, so it's a really great thing. So I'm going to throw a bunch of information at you, and then we're going to have some more discussion. Our topic this morning is, you know, what is faith development, what is moral development? And I want to just say that they're not the same thing, but they're related. Because we all, every person, develops a moral sense. And that may be something that we, you know, depending, you know, even the person that we may think is the most amoral or immoral person has a moral sense. And so that's just a natural thing that happens developmentally. And there's a lot of overlap, and I can give you lots of charts and talk about lots of different people. There's a lot of overlap with our psychological development along with our moral development. And our faith development, what a lot of studies have found is that faith development and moral development are very closely linked. And so those people who have some element of a faith community or some kind of faith formation in their life, that impacts their moral development. And so that's just a kind of interesting thing. I'm going to talk about very quickly kind of three major kind of researchers, thinkers who have done work in developmental things with children, moral development, and then faith development. The first one is Piaget. You may be familiar with Piaget. He came up with this kind of sequence of development that has to do with your sensory motor development. It's the very youngest development that, you know, this is from birth to, you know, probably 2 years old, where they're just figuring out how to use your hands and how to use your feet and, you know, how to verbalize things. It's all about what's coming in, the sensory kind of things. The next thing is the pre-operational, which is really 2 to 7, which, depending on what culture you live in, is preschool age or very early school age. Some school, you know, one thing I love about the Swedes is they don't start school until kids are 7. And there's a lot of arguments for that being developmentally more appropriate, because developmentally they're more prepared for schooling when they get to be about 7 years old. You can see a big shift in kind of the educational structure that happens. But this is where they're figuring out right from wrong in a very concrete kind of way, and they've kind of learned something about their body, but they're going, it's a time of rapid developmental growth in children. And then there's the concrete, what he calls the concrete operational phase, which is from roughly 7 to 12 years old. And this is where kids begin to really articulate very concrete ideas of the world, of what's right and what's wrong. And they are very much in that kind of logic stage where, you know, you do this, you don't do that. A pretty rational and pretty static and pretty concrete world. And then he comes to the last stage he has is the formal operational, which is really from 12 years on. He doesn't break it down any further than that. And that's all of the kind of tasks we have in adulthood, where we begin to integrate things and differentiate ourselves and see the complexity in things. So then a man called Kohlberg came along and built on Piaget's findings, and he broke it down into three stages. And the first one he calls preconventional. And preconventional is that youngest stage where most of the motivation comes from the notion of obedience and punishment. And so it's about your actions and their consequences. It's you know, no, don't touch that. You know, it's reward and punishment in a very classic kind of way. And in this time, he would, and this, I mean, it's very interesting stuff. If you ever want to read about it, I'll give you tons of articles. You know, he really kind of also has some of the Freudian stuff of the ego, the id, the ego, and all that kind of stuff. So this is kind of that very basic, you know, self-individual, the world is seen strictly through their own, the child's eyes. The next stage he has is the conventional stage, and this is where kids begin to develop an interpersonal sense of this is me and that's you, and how am I going to relate to this? There's a very strong sense of authority and social order, and they begin to internalize themselves as either a good person or a bad person, or this is what constitutes a good person versus this is what constitutes a bad person. And then there's the post-conventional, and this is all Kohlberg again. And this is where he talks about things like the social contract, you know, which is that philosophical idea, and where you see then the differentiation begins to happen. And then the task really, as you go along in adulthood, becomes a kind of universality where you have an internal morality that then relates to the rest of the world, and you begin to have a sense of compassion and feel less threatened by difference. Because a lot of times in childhood, there's a lot, you feel a lot of threat if you're different than someone else. So like when Matt said, you know, I was able to say in this high school class, I don't believe the same thing. That is a real task of differentiation that a lot of kids can't do because we haven't trained them that it's okay to do that. Because we live in a society that very much is about conformity. So even though we talk about individuality, there's certain ways that you can express your individuality. Then a man called Fowler came along, and Fowler took this research and then did a lot of study and looking at children and in terms of faith development. He tried to really look specifically at how does faith develop. And he broke it down into six stages, and this is across the whole spectrum of the lifetime. Okay, so it's not just children. And the first stage, which he calls stage zero, which is birth to 2 years old, is the primal stage or the undifferentiated stage. Completely undifferentiated, it's primal thing, is just trying to experience all those same tasks that both Piaget and Kohlberg identified. And the big thing that he identified in faith development in this stage was the need for safety in their environment. That the biggest thing that they need is to see that their environment is safe, and therefore they can take on the tasks of development. And so so it's a really big thing for the faith development that in those very early stages, when you think there's nothing going on, there's actually a lot going on, according to Fowler, as far as a child's sense of identity, and that the development of the identity can be is in a safe place, so that there's structure, and within that structure they feel very safe. The next stage for him is called the intuitive projective stage. This is ages 3 to 7. And this is where it is characterized by exposure to the unconscious mind. And so he has also a lot of the kind of some of the images of that language of Freud or Jung. And there's a kind of fluidity of the thought patterns. And in this stage, Fowler says, religion is mainly learned through experiences, stories, images, and people they come in contact with. And so this is where you know we really see our children's formation becomes an important thing, both in our homes and in the environments that our children are in. And so whether that's a church environment or any other environment, the stories and the experiences that our children have are what is shaping them. And so, you know, like I with Bill and Dell, when you say, you know, you didn't really have that kind of experience, you had some building blocks there from being in a situation that I think now as an adult you can tap into, and then somewhere along the line developmentally that didn't, perhaps, you know, you've articulated that didn't kind of go into a deeper level. But those building blocks perhaps were there. And so, you know, it's funny how you can look back and say, okay, maybe that did something and I didn't even realize it. And I think this is where liturgy is a really great example to us of what can happen with the formation, the faith formation piece. Because what we believe about liturgy, and of course we're a liturgical church, we have a certain structure in our church, and what we believe, why we believe it matters. We don't think it matters just because, you know, oh gosh, I really like it when it's orderly. I mean, a lot of us do. But the real reason that it matters is because over time, it changes us. It shapes us, and it transforms us. And so it really matters the environments that we put our children in. That's what I think this stage of Fowler's thing really shows us. It also matters the stories that they're hearing. And so things like exposure to media, and I saw interestingly that the American Association of Pediatrics changed their guidelines, where they had said before that children should not be exposed to screens like iPads, telephones, computer screens, television screens.
That horse is out of the barn.
Yeah.
Well, under the age,
under the age of two, and now they've changed it to
18 months or something.
Yeah, to 6 months earlier, recognizing that. They say there are some positive things that children can do, and the horse is out of the barn. You know, children, I mean, how many times have we, either ourselves or been somewhere with our children or seen someplace where there's a child in a stroller with an iPad, and mom's, you know, doing whatever, dad's doing whatever, and the child is interacting with the iPad. I mean, I can remember times where someone has come to see me, and they've had a child, and I'll pull up a game, and they'll be like, and I'll say, well, here, they can just push the buttons on this while we talk. And so, you know,
we have 13-month-old babies know that on our phones, which we leave out, they come across the phone, and in order to get it to light up, they know they have to push the home button.
Mm-hmm.
13 months old, like,
right? Yeah, no. So,
well, if they don't get the passcode, you're okay.
What they do is then they start doing this, and then they lock us out of our phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. 13 months.
One of my favorite stories from our children. We have three sons, and our oldest son. You know, he was the first one, so we didn't have a clue. You know, it's just fascinating his development. Great baby, happy baby. And when he was about 14 months old, and we had just moved, and we were in this house, a long story, but we were in this house, and the television was on, and my parents were there, and we were all in the other room, and this television was on with a PBS program, and the PBS program was about native dancing in Latvia or something like that, and they were doing the native dancing, and as part of the native dancing, they would go around in a circle, and then they would clap each other's hands, and then they would pat each other on the face. And so, and we're all over here, and Matthew, we think, is over here, and we're having a nice conversation. And then about 20 minutes after the show ended, Matthew starts moving around the floor and comes up and starts touching our face. We didn't even recognize that he even knew that the TV was on. It was in the background for all of us, we thought. And children are like sponges. And they are taking in information rapidly. They know how to turn the phone on. They're taking in things that we don't even see in the environment. Because when he started doing that, we were kind of alarmed at first. We thought, well, is he slapping us? And then we made the connection that he had seen this on TV and he was mimicking that behavior. Without us even, there was nothing said. It's just a fascinating thing. And so that happens all the time. Children, our brains are wired to be taking in information and to learn things. We now have this information coming at us at a really rapid pace, and Dan could talk more about that with the brain. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but I'm putting you on the spot. If you think of something you want to say about that, jump in. But
yeah. Tell me what to.
If you feel so inclined. So okay, so that's stage one. So 0 and 1. Stage two for Fowler is mostly school-aged children, and this is the mythical literal faith level. And so this is where the stories that Kohlberg talks about become really important. And children begin to develop a really strong sense of justice, of right and wrong. And you can see this when you see kids play together. You know, he took my toy. This is not right. Or the teacher let them go in front of the line in front of me. They have a really strong, natural kind of sense of right and wrong. And they tend to begin, this is where they're introduced to metaphor and symbols. And it's a really important place in faith development where we have to help them translate the metaphor and the symbol, or else they get locked into a literal place where things that are metaphoric or symbolic become literal in their minds. And interestingly, this is totally my personal opinion, I think we have a lot of adults in the world who are locked into this space in their faith development where things that were never intended to be literal are taken as literal, and they become the dictating thing to in their faith life. Mm-hmm. And so it's, but as parents, we have the task of holding attention for our children, because we have to be able to articulate and have those conversations where we don't have the answer. You know, we are, tend to be mom and dad, we have all the answers, and we have to not be that. And we have to be questioners along with the with our kids. So
it's really interesting, because I ran into this on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day, when I was doing college ministry at Texas A&M. We've got all these college students who are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, who can articulate that there is metaphor and there is imagery and there is, in literature, even in their history classes, that they can make the distinction that in real life, not everything is literal, not everything is black and white, not everything is either right or wrong, that there are all kinds of degrees of ambiguity and grayness. But when it comes to the Bible, when it comes to their faith, when it comes to their church upbringing, they're not able to do the same thing. And so I was having to kind of really work with them about context and about all of these different things that come into play, particularly with the Bible. And I was fascinated by how is it that they can do this with everything else in their life, but not with their faith life. And I think it's this. And I think when you said that the previous stage, that where they're, it's at 12 years old, with the previous sociologist or that you were talking about, 12 years old, where that kind of happens somewhat naturally. I think if I think back to my own upbringing, and I wonder about the kind of church's job from 12 years old on. What are we not doing? Or what are we not doing well from 12 years old on? I mean, it's like you go through in the Episcopal Church, you go up through all the children's ministry stuff, and then you get into confirmation class. And after confirmation class, we don't see half of the kids that used to be here.
Right.
And I think that's where that formation ends for a lot of our people.
Certain lines are reluctant to be crossed.
Right. Sure.
Yeah, I want to echo that too. And I think it's one place that the developmental stuff helps. I mean, I had to memorize all those stages. And we had little kids at the time, and it was like, well, what good is this doing? Oh, yeah, he's in the formal operations stage of development. Wow, okay. But part of what it, I think part of what it tells me looking back, not that we have to formally apply them, but just intuitively to sense that what we're doing within one age is different from other ages. And like you're saying about the development of the ability to think in a nuanced, independent way. Well, sometimes if they're grade schoolers, what they're about is learning all the rules and learning all the facts, and they will spout rules and facts forever. And they may be in the stage of needing to internalize as much of that as possible, and why not feed them with stuff related to faith, and they can memorize rules and facts and apply it rigidly if that's what they do. But then in teenage years, or certainly in college years, if all you're doing is applying rules and facts, then you're right, you're missing something in your development. So what we do with a teenager is going to be really different from a grade schooler who we may or may not push to think more independently.
Well, one of the things that I had, thinking about what you're saying, Matt, is you know, is there an issue, because I may or may not have a conversation about literal translations of the Bible regularly. Possibly.
Okay. Welcome back in attorney.
But I think it's interesting that, you know, even that, so, you know, my dad was military. We went to Episcopal churches all around the world, but high school was on the East Coast. And I, even in those conversations with my friends in high school here, had you not been in A&M, had you been at George Mason or been at Georgetown, would your experience with that have been different? Is there an environment here within South Texas, within Texas, within the parts of the South,
absolutely,
where those
sure
other faith bases
sure
that teach, no, these are the rules and this is it, bleed in?
Yeah,
of course.
Absolutely, yeah, it's very contextual, yeah.
And even, so I my mother's biology teacher,
mm-hmm,
and going back to the early, or early, the foundation of our faith, so I grew up knowing that there were, science and the Bible don't always match up, and she always, from an early age, taught me about that the Bible stories were not meant to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout my life, you know, I'd ask the questions again, and is this literal or is this not? And she would say, you know, she'd say you have to, though there's truth with a capital T and there's truth with a lowercase t, and there, you know, and knowing that what it all means,
right,
what this means, the Bible means in your relationship with God, mm-hmm, but not necessarily as scientific proof of
right
how our world is.
Yeah,
and
very
so
different way.
And I think, though, that so as I grew up, I was able to look at the whole Bible differently, mm-hmm, and because I had that foundation of science from my mother.
Yeah, that's great. That's
I think absolutely, and it's definitely a geographic thing,
yeah,
too, that plays into that. I mean, I remember our first Old Testament class in seminary, and our Old Testament professor talked about there being a difference between something being factual and something being true,
mm-hmm,
and can something be true even if it's not factual?
Mm-hmm.
And there were some people in my class whose heads were exploding. Like, what are you talking about?
We just talked about that on Saturday in the FM. So.
Okay.
Well, I don't want to beat up the Baptist church, but I will. But I think, you know, I was never, and we studied the Bible a lot, but we were never taught that, especially the Old Testament, was a piece of literature. It was more that it was exactly that. It was truth and fact, and it was not to be questioned, almost. So it was almost sacrilege if you did start to not take things literally and try to just pull out those elements that speak to our moral development or whatever, you know. But the thing that I remember is at around age 12 or so, we transitioned from hearing the stories to more the psychosocial development piece, I think, where it's more about just joining the faith community and not really diving back into those stories,
mm-hmm,
to see how they apply to our development in life. But it wasn't until I found the Episcopal Church, we joined St. Thomas in College Station, I guess 2007, somewhere around there. So it was later in our life, but it was the reason we became Episcopalians, because we continued to search and question, and we weren't finding the answers we were needing in our previous denomination. And when we joined the Episcopal Church, what I love about it, and I've heard it here several times, is we don't presume to have all the answers, but we welcome the questions. And that's what we were looking for, is to be able to go forward and not, you know, beat the bushes saying, you know, absolutely this is the way it is, but to be able to beat the bushes saying, we don't know what it is, but we're looking for it.
Yeah.
And we welcome the search as much as the answer.
That's great. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a big part of development, and I know that's what we're talking about, but Robin always tells a story, and even though it's Robin's story, I've been hearing it for 20 years, and it's truth. And again, not to beat up the Baptist
Robin
church.
Is her sister.
Oh, sorry, Robin's my sister, sorry.
Yeah.
So she had the experience Matt had at Baylor at one of her religious classes, and she got the opposite answer. Teacher pulled her out and said, you sit down and shut up, you'll pass this class. If you don't, you're going to fail.
Right.
And so it brought her closer into the Episcopal Church. That's how she ran away from Baylor. But how do you do that? How do you make sure they're getting to ask the questions that you guys were searching for as adults, as children, in an environment where the people around them aren't the people also asking the questions? And I think that's one of the things we talked about a lot in the, what do we call that? thing, the 3-day...
Oh, the Formation Summit.
The Summit.
Formation Summit.
Yeah.
Was that we talked about defending our faith, and I think the people that were there didn't understand. They're like, oh, okay, well, you guys want to do apologetics. And we're like, no, we want to walk up to a Baptist and explain why it's okay that we're asking questions, and we want our kids to be able to do the same things. Again, not to beat up on the Baptist Church, just an example. And I think that's what, like, I know, like, that's where we're trying to transition to. How do we explain that?
But that's why I love this Sunday school class this semester. It's mimicking what the children are learning, because our children do come home with questions, and we homeschool, and so I have a lot of Bible curriculum at home, but not all of it is Episcopal. And
sure,
so
sure, yeah.
You find a lot of literal translations, even for a 10-year-old, and he'll say, see, Mom, I told you that the snake was devil, and the devil came into the Garden of Eden, and I thought, so glad we had this class so
thank
that we could
Matt.
Talk about things like that, for giving me answers so that I can say...
Well,
there are lots of ways to look at this, and there are
right.
different ways to look at it, and it's not always the literal interpretation. There are other ways, so that it was so refreshing to have this backup knowledge
right.
that we might not have had otherwise.
Yeah.
So I love that this class is providing this, an outlet to go back and talk further with
yeah.
our kids on
one,
things they might not have gotten.
One thing
okay. go ahead.
I was just gonna say, one thing I picked up on in your comment a minute ago, David, I think, and this was true of many of my students at A&M, a lot of the influence of some of the other Protestant denominations is that around that age of 12 is when we kind of stop doing
mm-hmm.
biblical story study in community,
right.
and it becomes part of your faith journey to read the Bible on your own, which is not a bad thing,
right.
but if you don't also then have that work done, being done in community, then all you're able to do is read the black and white text and go, this is it. I just read it and accept it and period. And so when we were doing Bible study stuff with college students, it was like, this is the first time for many of them since they were in Sunday school as kids that they were doing Bible study in community.
Right.
That wasn't the pastor standing up and telling them what this was about. But this was conversational. This was all, we're all learning this together. We're all studying this together.
So I have a funny story real quick. So I was raised that it was literal, and that if you questioned, it was about your faith. And if you had these questions, then it made it to where maybe you didn't have faith, and shame on you, and this sort of thing. So I convinced my mother to let, I wanted to leave home really badly when I was 18. So I convinced her to let me go to Austin because I was going to St. Edward's University, and Mom, I'm gonna go to church, and they're Catholic. And
mm-hmm.
My very first semester, I took Old Testament, mm-hmm. and it was a nun that I'm very indebted to now. I don't know who she is, but she, right first class, said, it's not to be taken literal. Let's talk about context. Let's talk about who wrote it, how it was transcribed from book to book to book, and what's lost, and translation, and all of this. And I had the epiphany, like, this is amazing.
I love these stories so much more now.
So I call my mom. Oh, till this day, she regrets, she says, sending me to Austin, to St. Edward's University. But it was great. I loved it. So it was an eye-opener for me.
Just let me say, 2 minutes worth of stuff. I have Fowler's stuff here, and PJ, I'll let you have that at the end. One other person that I highly recommend is Robert Coles. I brought two of his books. He has written extensively and spent an incredible amount of time with children and done research about their spiritual lives and about their moral lives. And his books, they're anecdotal, so I highly recommend them. But they're four things that he says that I think are important to remember. So I'm going to throw these at you real quick. Kids are looking for moral engagement and direction. And so children naturally ask moral questions. They ask, they want to be in conversation about those kinds of things. So don't be afraid of it. That's one of his big recommendations. The second one is kids need a sense of purpose and direction in life. And they're going to get it somewhere. And so that's another place to be engaging them. And he encourages that you teach your children how to have moral introspection. And that's to look inside and wrestle with things. And he has great examples. He's a psychiatrist, works at Harvard and MIT, and talks about these children who face life and death, who have illnesses and stuff. And they confront moral questions better than adults do. And so don't be afraid of that.
And that ties into one of the things that we talked about last week that Brene shared, which was those moments can happen when we're vulnerable with and in front
yeah.
of our our children.
Yes, absolutely.
And we're having these conversations with and in front of our children rather than always saying we've got the answer.
And then at one point, and this is a little later, it's very important as parents to encourage our children to make the movement from thought to action. And we do that primarily through our own example and then through our words. And there's some interesting research about that, but anyway. And then the importance, he talks a lot about, of your example as a parent. And I know Matt talked about that with wholehearted thing. He talks about in one of these the importance of teaching our children to be like pilgrims and think of life as a pilgrimage and that it's a voyage of discovery that's ongoing and that it's the journey that really is important and that they're part of that journey and that we're on it together. And so I want to leave you with a quote from Mary Oliver, which I think is good to think about with our children and with ourselves. She says, "Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished." I think that invites us to think about our faith in a new way. So I'll put these out if you want to grab one of these and put it on the table.
Thank you all.
Next week we're going to have some psychologists and pediatricians here to answer questions. See what you want to look at.